Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Well, today is Wednesday, August 13th, and arrests in D.C. as some 850 additional officers have been deployed. And so 23 arrests were made in the nation's capital city, according to a Salem Daybreak insider, on the first night of President Donald Trump's crackdown on crime in Washington, D.C. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt shared the news Tuesday during a press briefing. She said approximately 850 officers and agents were deployed with arrests for crimes such as homicide, gun offenses, drug possession with the intent to distribute, evasion, loot, acts, stalking, driving under the influence, reckless driving, and more. Sounds exactly like Chicago, frankly. But she said additionally, six illegal guns were seized during the operation. And meanwhile, Senator Mike Lee moves to repeal the Home Rule Act. That was the act that was established in 1973, giving a greater degree of operational autonomy to the governance of D.C. and established a mayor and a city council. But the Utah Republican is arguing that it's time to jettison it. So Lee is urging the passage of the Bringing Oversight to Washington and Safety to Every Resident Act, or the Bowser Act. See what you did there. To repeal the Home Rule Act and to restore federal oversight over the district. So let's welcome in Orrin McIntyre, who is host at The Blaze. And Orrin, we've spoken before about the Home Rule Act, about federalizing D.C. And instead of going into kind of, you know, the legal or the constitutional, I want to get your angle on the political here, because I think that this is a huge win overall, especially with the midterms looming next year for Donald Trump.
I think that's right. I think ultimately people wanted to see law and order under Donald Trump. And obviously the administration has had a rocky few weeks in other areas. So getting the focus shifted back to some of its core values is really critical. I think a lot of people want to see Washington, D.C. be a safe place, and they know that it's not. And the leadership there is fighting tooth and nail to avoid all of the policies that ultimately would keep the city safe. And so I think a lot of people are happy ultimately to watch the president take action and restore order to the nation's capital.
Yeah, well said. And meanwhile, Texas Democrat legislators who fled to Illinois are now returning. So John Sexton on Hot Air says this: it looks like the Texas Democrats have decided their stunt has generated enough media. They can now declare victory and go home. There are reports at ABC News that the Dems who fled the state now plan to return, having wasted an entire special session in hotels in California, Illinois, and New York. And so the Senate in Texas has now passed the new redistricting. And so all eyes now turn to the House. Where do we stand in terms of actual accountability for this stunt?
I mean, I could be wrong about this. I'm not the biggest watcher of Texas politics, but I think this is kind of a semi-regular thing that the Texas Democrats actually do, fleeing the state and not doing the vote. So I would be interested to see if they're actually held accountable in any way this time around, but I don't think this is particularly unique in Texas politics. And if I remember correctly, there hasn't been any kind of other situation in which Democrats actually were expelled from their seat, that kind of thing. So I think ultimately this is a little bit of theater that we've gone through multiple times.
Yeah, and I think that Texans and certainly Republicans are going to be a little frustrated if now that, you know, everybody's back and the stunt is over, and if all of these new redistricting ultimately is passed and then signed by Governor Abbott, that he just drops the Texas Supreme Court petition to vacate their seats. That'll likely go through the whole process and be appealed, even if the Texas Supreme Court rules for them. And so, you know, we still have a long way to go. But at the same time, even if now the Democrats have returned, business is continuing, accountability should continue as well, even if that's not until, you know, a year or more from now. I'd like to see them continue that, as well as Attorney General Paxton. But this is also the main story that I wanted your commentary on this morning. Orrin McIntyre, my special guest from The Blaze. Speaking of Texas Attorney General Paxton, he posted yesterday, breaking, "I'm suing big pharma drug manufacturer Eli Lilly for bribing providers to prescribe its medications. I will not stand by while corporations unlawfully manipulate our healthcare system to line their own pockets." So he's saying in his press release that he sued the pharmaceutical giant for bribing and illegally inducing medical providers to prescribe its most profitable drugs that are used primarily for weight loss and diabetes treatments. So what do you make of this lawsuit?
I think it's a huge deal. You know, one of the things that unfortunately was a black stain against, I think, conservatism for a long time was its support of big pharma, just thinking, okay, well, ultimately corporations are at some level on our side, even if they aren't the best people. But after COVID, I think a lot of people finally recognize that actually these people are not on your side. They do not like you. They are not conservative or right-wing in any way. And you need to stand up to their abuses. It's not okay to give them a free pass. I think we're seeing big changes with President Trump, you know, negotiating the deal to get the favored nation status when it comes to drug pricing. I think we're seeing this act in Texas to punish big pharma for its abuses of bribing providers. And so it's finally great to see the Republicans recognize that these are not good actors, and it's okay to go after them and exact a price when they are ultimately preying on the American people.
Yeah, and you know, this really goes into what HHS Secretary Kennedy has been talking about in terms of the whole medical community that have more of an incentive, as he typifies it, to prescribe medications and really line the pockets of big pharma instead of looking out first and foremost for the health and interest of their patients. And there's kind of been a lot of online chatter and some pushback against that is even some conservatives, you know, who I follow are saying, well, really, I mean, we, you know, would frontline doctors really kind of knowingly be part of, you know, this kind of broader scheme to say, well, even if we don't think this is in the best interest, we're still going to go ahead and prescribe medication. But my view on it is that, you know, a lot of these all of these medical doctors have been trained in medical school that isn't particularly holistic. It's all about treating the symptoms. You know, it's all about Western medicine. And that's what they've been taught to do. And I mean, it's a lot like attorneys. You know, when we go through law school, we're taught to view the Constitution through the lens of what Supreme Court precedent already is, not what the U.S. Constitution actually says. And you have to kind of go back, pull back from your training, or maybe we could even call it indoctrination, to say, okay, but is this really the best argument, or is this really the best overall diagnosis and prescription? And so when Kennedy is saying some of these things and I think really questioning the entire medical profession overall, do you think ultimately this is good policy for America?
For sure. Like you said, you know, when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And when you've been trained as a doctor to say every single ailment has to be solved with a drug, then even if you're not, you know, being completely bribed in the sense that you, you know, well, this is how I solve these things no matter what, then you're being nudged in the right direction. I think that's probably more the case for most doctors. But ultimately, you know, as you're saying with Secretary Kennedy, you need to understand that there are other options for treatment, that there are lifestyle approaches, there are other ways to view, you know, these ailments, and it's not always just prescribing the most expensive thing that will make some kind of profit. That's a big shift for a lot of doctors and a big shift for patients. It's an entirely different way to look at treatment, but one that is ultimately far better. It doesn't mean that ultimately you don't use a modern medication when it's necessary. There are many cases where it is absolutely necessary. But making that one option of many rather than something that you're being directly financially incentivized to do, that's a big change, something that's really critical, and it's a good shift in general for, I think, Americans when you're looking at a movement that I think was a big part of the Trump administration's win, the MAHA movement. I think this is something that people expect from Republicans now, and they should.
Yeah, and the MAHA movement, I think, has become kind of a signature facet of the overall second Trump administration and what a lot of Americans perceive as this mandate, because there is a wide call to make America healthy again. A lot of people have really heard what Secretary Kennedy is saying, that, you know, we need to not just prescribe more, we need to get to the fundamental root cause. And overall, you know, this, I think, coming at a time that's right on the heels of what we all experienced during the COVID narrative and this kind of deep distrust for the pharmaceutical industry as a whole, I think is coming at a really good time.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I think that after we had, you know, everything that happened with COVID, there was a very serious mindset shift when it came to the right wing. Conservatives were no longer just saying, okay, well, whatever my doctor says, whatever the corporation says, whatever Big Pharma says, that ultimately these people might be on my side or they may in some way be aligned with me. I think that that mindset has shifted quite radically. And now it's understood that on the right, conservatives are looking for, like you said, a more holistic way to approach health. That doesn't, again, mean that suddenly you just throw off modern science, but it means that you are far more skeptical of simply being handed whatever Big Pharma is, you know, peddling this month. And instead, you're looking for the actual treatment. What are the real roots of the problem? How do you address that? Maybe it does need medication, but maybe there are much better options that are not going to line the pockets of these corporations. And so I think a lot of people, again, are very happy to watch that become a big part of what the right is doing.
Yeah, well said. And I'm speaking with Orrin McIntyre, who's a host at The Blaze. You can follow him on X at Orrin McIntyre, A-U-R-O-N. And that one took me a while, frankly, to learn how to spell. But it's easy. He's a great follow, especially in some of the arguments and conversations that you get into. But overall, Orrin, I think that one of the other mandates that Kennedy is looking at is trying to expand the options, because instead of kind of being just pushed by the way that we've in the U.S. kind of come to see our medical healthcare solutions being, has been a lot more of the pharmaceutical driven instead of some of these holistic approaches just based on how the insurance industry works. And one of the things I would love to see is sort of an expansion of options, having like your PPOs and your health savings accounts and, you know, some of those things, even if not directly insurance, be able to provide for, you know, some of these alternative treatments that maybe, you know, don't have the MD after their name, but it's a holistic approach that's the choice of the individual to go to a provider for treatment.
Yeah, it's one of those situations where, again, you think that there's just this narrow binary of, okay, there's these silly, you know, new age treatments, and then there's the serious medical, you know, professional hospital doctor treatments. And, you know, what I've found over the years, having many friends with different conditions that in some cases were considered terminal, there are options out there that are actually very effective that would not necessarily be considered the most conventional treatments. Again, that doesn't mean I want to become some kind of granola, crunchy, you know, crystal hippie on healthcare. But it is just undeniable that we've narrowed our band of options, especially when it comes to insurance and how we can address serious illnesses. And people should be aware that there are options that aren't just constantly being hooked on whatever really expensive pharmaceutical is being sold. Again, sometimes it is. Sometimes that is ultimately the answer. But we should be able to open up that range of options and recognize that there are better ways to treat many of these things, and that forcing everyone into the same box because it's technically on, you know, whatever payment schedule the corporation will, you know, dole out for your insurance, I think it's important to shift that mindset.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Orrin McIntyre, you know, speaking of the granola people, I know all of those people because I'm originally from Boulder County, Colorado. So I agree with you. Expand that a little bit, but we'll be right back with more. I want you to picture this. Her name is Kayla. She is 17, alone, terrified, and pregnant. Sitting in a clinic, tears blurring, thinking abortion is her only option. Until she was offered a free ultrasound, paid for by a hero just like you. The moment Kayla heard her baby's heartbeat, the decision was made. And today, her little baby boy, Gabriel, is thriving because preborn walked with Kayla every step of the way. Now, multiply that by 38,000. That's how many babies preborn has helped save just this year. How many mothers preborn has come alongside with practical and spiritual resources to make motherhood possible. But here's the most important thing you will hear today. Their goal is to save 70,000 babies by the end of the year. And they can't do that without us. Every $28 provides that ultrasound, the moment everything changes. Will you be the reason the next Kayla chooses life? The reason Gabriel fulfills his destiny? To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or donate securely at preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, as 2026 heats up with the midterms, a lot of eyes are also on the governor's races that and seats that will be available across the country. And Florida is one of those, as Governor Ron DeSantis, unfortunately, in my opinion, is term limited. I think a lot of us in Florida would love to see him stay as governor. He's just racked up so many of those wins. But he has had this vacancy of lieutenant governor, his main deputy and second, vacated as Jeanette Nunez, who had originally held that post, went to be university president a few months ago. And so after the Florida legislative session and then also the special session was winding down, then it was time to pick a lieutenant governor. And yesterday, Governor DeSantis picked State Senator Jay Collins to be Florida's lieutenant governor. And this coming from the Tallahassee AP. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis tapped Republican State Senator Jay Collins to be his next lieutenant governor Tuesday. It's a closely watched appointment by the two-term governor who can't run for re-election in 2026 and has been working to cement his legacy as his time leading the state winds down. So I think everybody's kind of, you know, well aware of what's going on here. And it was great to see Governor DeSantis and Senator Collins at that press conference yesterday in Tampa, and seeing them kind of do a little bit of a media tour. They were on Hannity on Fox News last night, and even just that visual to see Governor DeSantis right there with Senator Collins. I think it's going to be a very interesting primary now. So let's welcome in John Cardillo, who's a GOP strategist, fellow Florida resident, and overall really great friend of the show. So John, I love to see this appointment. I have so much respect for Senator Jay Collins, who is a Green Beret, you know, really amazing military veteran. And what do you make of where Florida is headed?
I love it. I love it. I actually texted Jay yesterday right before the appointment and said some, you know, give him congratulations and said something like, this is the last time I'll call you Jay after you're sworn in as lieutenant governor and hopefully governor one day. I think it's a phenomenal appointment, not only a Green Beret, Jenna, but for your listeners who don't know, lost his leg in combat. Was shot, lost his leg in combat. Another battle was shot, triaged his own wound until the medics arrived because they were under heavy fire. I mean, this guy is absolutely the real deal. He's an American hero, he's a warrior, but a true conservative who's been pretty much on the right side of every issue in the state of Florida. So going into this primary season, if there's anybody who can carry the DeSantis mantle and continue the policies that have given Florida – you know, you came here, Jenna, under DeSantis' policies, given Florida nearly 1.4 million GOP voter advantage. I think it's Jay Collins. I think he's going to do a tremendous job as lieutenant governor, and really, really hope he announces his candidacy for governor for 26.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, a lot of Floridians and also, you know, people around the country certainly, but especially Floridians and even new ones or relatively new ones like myself who moved here because of the conservative policies of Governor DeSantis, want to be in the free state of Florida. We want this to continue. And Florida has been the blueprint for, you know, the rest of the nation. And Governor DeSantis has really led the way in terms of policies. And yet we've seen that his own legislature in some ways has been acting very, you know, rhino-ish, like Republican in name only. And I think he's not going to, you know, go out as sort of this, you know, the next legislative session being anything like a lame duck. He's going to continue to push to be the warrior that he is. And he's pushing to have a no property tax for homeowners, which is, you know, something I think a lot of us here support, and, you know, many other things that just make this state great in terms of policy. And yet he also understands that he needs to pass the mantle and to continue that legacy as he steps back from being governor. And so if Senator, now Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins does enter the race, this is going to set up an interesting primary on the Republican side. I'm not really sure that that whoever the Democrat is running is really going to matter in this state because of how many more registered Republicans we'll see. I guess that'd be the you know, in my opinion, the worst of all possible alternatives. But the primary, because Congressman Byron Donalds has months ago declared his candidacy and is also endorsed by President Trump. So how do you see this contest overall shaping up when I think Byron clearly has the national name recognition, but Lieutenant Governor Collins is really loved by Floridians in a way that I just don't see Byron Donalds having that same appeal within the state?
So you touched on so many critical points. I mean, you made some really excellent points there that cut to the root of the issue. So let's unpack them. First and foremost, yeah, Byron Donalds has pretty much been capped. It's around 34%. He's the only candidate in the race. And in most polls, from the most reputable pollsters to ones who are questionable, there's one constant. He's trailing candidate. I love some things Trump has done, and I dislike others. And, you know, I was critical. I was with DeSantis in the primary. But I think Trump, by and large, has been doing a phenomenal job. I just adore what he's doing with crime in D.C., and I think it's going to make a real dent. That said, Donald Trump, but for a few, has made absolutely horrible endorsements with regards to Floridians in politics. Joe Gruter's pick to run the Republican National Committee is the most rhino of rhinos. Now, one place I will disagree with you a bit, Jenna, there's a state senator here in Florida named Jason Pizzo, who, all things being equal, will most likely be the Democrat nominee. He's formidable. He presents as a moderate. In fact, I got into arguments with Joe Gruters, who will be the chairman of the RNC when he ran the Florida GOP. He was defending the Democrat, Jason Pizzo. So Gruters is the ultimate rhino. But Jay Collins is a real conservative, and Florida conservatives see that. There is a mountain of opposition research that will eventually drop on Byron Donalds. He has arrests for financial crimes, for dealing marijuana while at Florida A&M University. But the worst thing about Donalds is he's paid $300,000 to a guy named Larry Wilcoxon, who's a career criminal. We could do a whole show. And this guy was arrested for molesting a child in 2006. The case was dropped because the child victim was an unreliable witness. I mean, he's done some horrible, horrible things. Byron Donalds has paid this guy over $300,000 in campaign funds and considers him his best friend. Now, you contrast that guy's mugshot in an orange jumpsuit to a photo I saw yesterday of Jay Collins as a Green Beret in the early days of the war on horseback in Afghanistan fighting the Taliban. I think Floridians are going to want the warrior, not the guy, Byron Donalds, with his own criminal history, who's hanging around career criminals, I mean real thugs. And so we have a very formidable Dem candidate in Jason Pizzo. If Byron Donalds the nominee, it's presumed he'll be the Dem candidate. If Byron Donalds is the nominee, the contrast of Pizzo to Donalds might cause some Republicans to sit out and might move independents and moderates to vote for the Dems. So we should be fine, but I just don't trust Donalds as the candidate. I think he's going to implode.
And, you know, that's a really fair point. John Cardillo, who's my special guest this morning, has been around Florida politics, you know, way longer than I have. He's kind of the person you want to go to if you want to talk about, you know, the history and then where we're at today. And, you know, speaking of Jason Pizzo, the state senator, you know, it's interesting, though, to me that he left the Democrat Party. I think this was back in May of this year, stepped down from his leadership position, declaring the Democrat Party dead and saying he'll run for governor as an independent. So I don't think he's going to get the Democrat nomination, obviously, but Florida hasn't elected a governor who's not a Democrat or a Republican candidate, at least according to Politico, for more than a century. But this is a guy who is positioning himself as a moderate. And I think the contrast of, you know, what some sources and consultants that I've spoken with, you know, are saying that even the Latino and Cuban community will more rally against someone like him than a Byron Donalds, just in terms of optics. And I think that's a real consideration for the primary when you look at all of the oppo that Byron Donalds really carries. I think a lot of people nationally aren't as aware of this because they've seen what he's done in Congress. They've seen what, you know, President Trump's endorsement, which carries a lot of weight, understandably, with a lot of people. But they're not really looking at the landscape of the Florida voter.
Yeah, true. Now, let me say one thing, Jenna. You're 100% correct that Pizzo switched to independent. But the reason I refer to him as the Dem candidate, Pizzo's a very wealthy guy, a very large family construction company, you know, enterprise commercial builders. He's donated so much money to Democrats that it's conceivable, and there's buzz, that Pizzo could run as an independent. The Dems might have a candidate, you know, they'll throw in a ceremonial figurehead candidate, have them drop out, and then throw their support behind Pizzo. Because then Pizzo controls them. Right now, he's not beholden to the far-left Nikki Fried Looney Tunes faction of the party. Now he becomes the nominee. Now the party has to be remade in his image. So I'm not discounting. He might have an eye behind his name, but I'm not discounting him still having the Democrat machine to help him, you know, win this race. But with regards, the biggest problem Donalds has, and I'll give you guys a piece of inside baseball. Won't tell the source, but a very reliable source spoke with President Trump, and Trump did not know about Byron's criminal history. Trump did not know about Byron's affiliation with Larry Wilcox, and when he made the endorsement, he doesn't particularly like some of the things Donalds is doing. And from what I was told from someone who spoke to the president about it, he kind of regrets the endorsement of Donalds. So I could see Donald Trump, if a really solid Republican jumped in, I could see Donald Trump doing what he did in the Phoenix congressional race between Blake Masters and Abe Hamadeh, endorsing all the Republicans and saying, hey, they're all great. You guys figure it out. They all have my support. And then he neutralizes the endorsement to Donald's. And I believe it's leaning that way. And if enough opposition research drops on Donald's, I think Trump might very well go that way.
That would be a game changer, certainly, and it'll be really interesting to see, especially as now Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins, it's projected he'll probably enter the race, you know, somewhere around early October. But even if he waits a little longer than that, you know, that's okay. That's not, you know, too far, because as you were telling me, and, you know, conversation, you know, that we have often offline, you know, that DeSantis himself didn't even enter the race until, what was it, January of 2018. So, you know, there's a lot of time.
January of election year. So they have the GOP, you know, another GOP candidate has time.
Yeah. And so let's talk, you know, so if President Trump ultimately does that and just, you know, endorses all of the Republicans for the primary, basically says, Florida, you choose, you know, make your own pick. Where does that leave Governor DeSantis in terms of an endorsement? Because I see this one being a little more tricky because on one hand, he wants to cement his legacy. Obviously, he deeply personally cares about the state of Florida. He wants the best candidate to win. But he's also looking ahead. I mean, whether or not he runs in 2028 is anybody's guess. He may. You know, he has a lot of options. You know, he's rising, in my view, in politics. And he's far from over. And so if he makes an endorsement and then that candidate ultimately doesn't prevail, is he kind of looking at this as, well, you know what, I'm going to do what I think is right anyway and make that endorsement? Or is he going to just help sort of behind the scenes and have an implicit endorsement but look ahead to perhaps 2028?
Well, it's great. It's really a great question. You know, I think he's given cover on this one because Jay is now his lieutenant governor. And there's really not going to be a lot of political fallout for backing the guy you appointed. I mean, it's almost it's difficult for DeSantis to not, if Collins does jump into the race, difficult to not endorse him, because how do you tell 23 million Floridians, trust this guy as my number two? If, God forbid, something happened to me, trust this guy to be governor, but I don't trust him enough to endorse him in the GOP primary. And so he kind of has to, you know, in my view. But I will tell you, I think, you know, Trump and DeSantis have a very good relationship these days. They speak often. They get along. There's a friendship there. They play golf together. Casey DeSantis, the First Lady of Florida, goes out and plays golf with them. I wouldn't be shocked. In fact, I'd be more surprised if this didn't happen than it did. But I would not be shocked if in 26, when he was turned out, or, you know, January 27, Ron DeSantis was offered a cabinet position in the Trump administration for those last 2 years. Because there's a genuine affinity and respect now between DeSantis and Trump, and they pick each other's brains. So I wouldn't write off Ron winding up, Governor DeSantis winding up in President Trump's cabinet. And I don't think him endorsing his lieutenant governor would affect that either way. So I think DeSantis' political future might be ending at the state level, but is just starting on the national level.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that, you know, nationally, well, there's a certain segment that's really dwindling, honestly, you know, people who are kind of holding on to, you know, the 2024 primary. And yet somehow, you know, they're totally fine with Rubio, who ran against Trump, with, you know, Vivek, with, you know, a ton of people who ran against Trump. Now, you know, they're friendly with Trump. Well, that's absolutely true with Governor DeSantis. And, you know, and I've seen it personally. I mean, I was there at Alligator Alcatraz opening and, you know, and seeing, and everybody saw on national television as well, you know, where President Trump really spoke incredibly highly Governor DeSantis. And you can just see that friendship. And, you know, and that's politics. You know, you run and you run against each other, and then one person wins, one person, you know, steps out of the race, and then you move forward. So ultimately, I think for both Trump and DeSantis, their goals are to overall make the state of Florida and America overall the best that they can. And that's something that Floridians, I think, should be really proud of, because we want the conservative policy in the state to continue.
Yeah, 100%. You know, you're right. I mean, there's that dwindling weirdo fringe part of the right-wing base that still holds a grudge about the primary. I liken these people to those Japanese soldiers they found in the jungle in, like, 1968, who didn't know World War II was over. So they were still fighting and charging and looked like maniacs. And that's what these people look like. They're fighting a battle that's long over. You've got Trump and DeSantis as really strong friends. And I think that's great, as you said, Jenna, for Florida and America. Because if we can continue both, you know, Senator Trump might differ on a couple of things.
Oh, and I think we're losing John, but that's okay, because we're already out of time. But congratulations to Florida's new Lieutenant Governor, Jay Collins, and looking forward to seeing what happens next year. And there goes John, but we'll have him again, and you can follow him on X, and we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, the left is utterly wringing their hands in protest and shock that President Trump has invited Vladimir Putin to set foot in America. And the Atlantic is basically shrieking. I was literally laughing as I read this piece. So the headline is, Trump invites Putin to set foot in America, as if, like, you know, he's putting his little tippy toe over here. Vladimir Putin is coming to America despite the international warrant for the Russian president's arrest, despite his years of hostile threats against NATO, and despite him showing no remorse for his invasion of a sovereign nation. none of that matters, according to The Atlantic, to President Donald Trump, who announced Friday night that he would meet the globally shunned leader this Friday in Alaska. What does it matter to Trump that he may be able to stop the bloodshed in Ukraine, the worst European conflict since World War II, fulfilling one of his biggest campaign promises? And it goes on and on and on. But what really is the art of the deal here for President Trump to set up this meeting in more of a rational tone than The Atlantic? Well, let's welcome in Matthew Tiermand, who's a journalist and political strategist. And Matt, what do you make of this meeting that is forthcoming?
Well, I mean, I see both sides of the issue. Ultimately, though, do you want peace or do you not want peace? And if there are no diplomatic attempts to broker peace, there will be no peace. You know, Putin is not a good faith player. That being said, the world is filled with not good faith players. Look at, you know, Trump's success in his first term with Kim Jong-un in North Korea. Little rocket man stopped throwing rockets into the air that threatened the entire region because Trump met with him and built some level of rapport. And then Trump's gone and he starts saber rattling again. So, you know, I give Trump a lot of credit for trying. I don't know how it shakes out. Certainly brokering peace and using other countries' territories as a chess piece to do so has its pitfalls, but again, nothing will happen unless there's an attempt to do something proactively, and, you know, good on Trump for trying. Obviously, the Ukrainian factions, pro-Ukraine factions, and Zelensky are somewhat up in arms, and in Trump's deal-making prowess, now he's doing something he's never done, which is, in fact, as we speak, they're gearing up for a call, Trump and European leaders, including the Germans, who have a vested interest in this, as sort of a de facto political leadership in the EU. And you have Matt Whitaker's ambassador in NATO, who's doing a lot of brokering that and doing a good job as well. You want peace, you have to make an attempt at diplomacy. So all the hand-wringing and politicking around it is you know, par for the course with quote-unquote this town, D.C., the Atlantic press room, et cetera.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that's where they get their clicks and views from, you know, is always making everything to be this kind of Hollywood style drama. And in fact, you know, for listeners who don't know, that's literally what D.C. it's kind of the slang term for D.C. is ugly Hollywood. And I think Trump made it a little prettier, you know, with some of the people's, of course, our first lady as well. But, you know, but that's really what it's called, because it's like this over dramatized media game that's always trying to make a bigger deal out of it than it is. But what do you make, Matt Tiermand, of the fact that reports are saying that Zelensky was not invited to this upcoming meeting? Is this first for, you know, Trump and Putin to talk and then kind of inform Zelensky? Or would it have been better, in your view, to kind of say, okay, let's have both of these parties sit down and Trump kind of be the broker?
Well, I think you have to walk before you run. And given the antipathy between Zelensky and Putin, and Zelensky is certainly well within his right to detest Russian action and Putin's revanchism that has cost, you know, many tens of thousands of Ukrainian deaths, there probably is nothing productive until some sort of framework can be offered to both sides. And the only way that that's going to take shape is Trump trying to make some inroads with Putin. I mean, how this thing shakes out with territorial ceding of Ukraine's territory, you know, that's the X factor. And Zelensky's not really in a strong position here. He's, you know, got a much more powerful military at his doorstep. We've seen what happens with that over now, you know, approaching 3 years. And the Ukrainians as well, you know, a year and a half ago or so, Ukrainian public sentiment was still, we will fight to the last Ukrainian because of national pride as well as the belief in national sovereignty. You know, another year of massive human loss, death toll, cities leveled, now Ukrainian Kiev residential buildings still getting attacked regularly. The sentiment has shifted, and most people there, I believe, want this thing ceased, full ceasefire. And given the geopolitics of the Far East region of Ukraine and historical ties to Russia, as well as now the Ukrainians who have left it and it's fully under Russian control, is it pleasant? No, war is not pleasant. Geopolitical battles are not pleasant, but it is what it is. I think there will have to be some ceding of territory in the Far East. I mean, this is an area that has been if not politically controlled directly over, you know, a sovereignty framework by Russians, it's been de facto controlled by Russians since roughly 2000, 2005. They were stuffing ballots there to try and get their preferred candidates like Yanukovych into power. So, you know, this is the realpolitik of the situation. It's ugly. War is ugly. You know, 1,000 years of history is ugly. They don't call Central and Eastern Europe the bloodlands for nothing. And, you know, good on Trump for trying to ameliorate this in some way, somehow.
Yeah. And, you know, and given this history, as you mentioned, of the strained, you know, relations globally, everything that's going on in terms of, you know, the Russia-Ukraine conflict, what concrete outcomes, if any, do you think we can realistically expect from this meeting? Or is this just kind of a first overture in saying, you know, we're trying to go down the diplomatic channel?
Yeah, I think it's the first overture. I think if, you know, Putin says we will not leave without, you know, these regions that are now Russian dominated, Trump may yield on this. And again, he's a deal maker. So, you know, offer a little, then there's some concessions and back and forth. Zelensky's not in a strong position. His people are pretty sick of him. You know, where he had people around him who were telling him no, he shipped those people off. Like, one of his military heads is now ambassador in the UK because he was a political threat to him. And that's seen on the ground in Ukraine. You know, a year ago, he would have won re-election easily. Now that's not necessarily the case. You know, a democracy should have rotation. Ukraine is of leadership, and Ukraine is trying, attempting to become a democracy and tie itself to the Western Europe more. Well, democracy is also ugly, and there have to be trade-offs. And there may be trade-offs here, and he may not like it. He may view it as failure. But if you can save the lives of more of the next generation of young Ukrainians, that's a win for everybody. It's a win for Russia, Ukraine, America, Europe, the world, and just morality. So, you know, this is too long in the tooth at this point. And there's nobody who's more pro-Ukraine versus Russia, as Russia is the aggressor and is always the aggressor for 1,000 years, than I am. That being said, we have to find a way to make peace.
So what's the biggest trap, in your view, that Putin could set on this meeting, either in negotiations or even just optically?
Ask too much. You know, ask for all of the land bridge to Crimea, all of Donbass, all the way up to Kharkiv. I think he knows. Maybe ask for Kharkiv. I don't think he would ever get Kharkiv. Kharkiv is a ethnically, culturally, historically, politically Ukrainian city, but it's also a geopolitically strategic city. It's where a lot of the industrial strength of the Soviet Union was. It's got heavy industry and foundries that can be utilized for things like making weapons. But if Putin over-asks, and Trump says, okay, we will be open to this, and doesn't draw a line somehow, and I don't know who's advising him on the geography of Ukraine at this point from the NSC, but if he, you know, accedes to, or even looks like he might be acceding to an overask by Putin, then it's DOA. The Ukrainians and Zelensky and the Europeans will not accede to that.
And so how do you think that, you know, this overall is being viewed by not just Trump's base, who I think is, you know, supporting him in virtually anything that he does, but, you know, there are still a lot of the, you know, kind of the middle section. And then, of course, the left is going to hate whatever. But how does this play overall, in your view, to the favorability of Trump, especially heading into the midterms, where a lot, frankly, is at stake?
You know, I don't think that the Trump base, the primary voting Republican MAGA base, is overly concerned with anything that happens in Russia, Ukraine. I think the majority of them are of the non-interventionist school, who just say not our circus, not our monkeys, not our problem. You know, they're more concerned with the political culture of what's going on in the Middle East. And unfortunately, the bifurcations that have occurred there are rather distressing and disgusting. You know, the Tucker crew, and many of them are in the White House sowing division or leaking to undermine Middle East policy. I think everybody just wants the Ukrainian-Russian conflagration over. And if he can deliver that, it helps him greatly in the midterms, because it's just another proof that he's effective, which he is.
And I'm speaking with Matt Tierman, who's a journalist and political strategist. You can follow him on X as well. And after this meeting, what headlines should the White House want?
We brought them to the table, and progress is being made. We have a pathway to a treaty, to a ceasefire. And anything, you know, short of Putin walking away with a photo op, you know, flipping Trump off, saying, no, this is untenable, we're going to continue what we're doing, will be spun, and probably correctly so, and construed as some small-level victory and, you know, next step on the way to achieving what the end goal is, which is a ceasefire.
Yeah, and so overall, how do you see this, Matt Tierman, playing into the broader Trump's broader foreign policy view as a whole? I mean, not just related to Russia. Then, you know, obviously has to deal with Zelensky in Ukraine. There's still, you know, a lot going on in Israel. There's still a lot going on, you know, with China, with Iran. Overall, I mean, is this kind of a separate piece, or do you think that this is being factored into kind of the broader overall foreign policy strategy?
You know, nothing exists in a vacuum. So holistically, the fact that America and Trump might be able to broker this factors into the general view of this idea that power pours a vacuum. America is stepping in once again, like they did in the Middle East, albeit through, you know, light endorsement and sanction of Israel doing the heavy lifting before America coming in and sort of cleaning up the last part of the mess, at least in this episode of, you know, the latest Middle East conflagration. I think it accrues positively to America's standing that Trump could come in and try and make something positive out of diplomacy. You know, there's another factor as well, another facet of this, which is, you know, Ukraine, Kiev, Zelensky want security guarantees they've already overtured a little bit. If we were to cede some territory, we would want explicit and implicit security guarantees. Well, Trump offered that via the rare earth mineral deal, which, by the way, was devised by Lindsey Graham when they were playing golf. He's the one who showed Trump the wealth of deposits that exist there. And I've said this, you know, many times in the last several months. It was ridiculous of Zelensky to get manipulated by, you know, politicking Dems to reject that. That's the greatest thing in the world. Countries that have American energy interests in their country don't get invaded by other countries. That is a implicit security guarantee. That would be a great outcome. You would create jobs and technological know-how and energy wealth in Ukraine. It would also accrue to American industrial and energy concerns. Good for us. America gets something. That's an America first idea. We're not just writing blank checks to the world. And you would also create a counterweight to Russia and China trying to be the end-all, be-all energy producer and distributor in these regions. So that's a win-win-win. And part of the reason Zelensky, in my view, has lost popularity is that game he played with that, or how he got played, when that is a really good thing that Trump was offering. We will invest in energy extraction and rare earths that will benefit you and us and Europe and the West. And then he punted on that and actually made it, you know, an ugly episode and really lost some credibility with Trump, with the West, and with his own people. So that's another facet. And I think that, you know, I think ultimately we will get there. And that's a good thing. And that's, again, Trump, you know, trade is good. We are looking out for our own interests. But by doing so, we're helping others that we are allied with or sympathetic to. I think that's very positive.
Yeah, and where is NATO in all of this? I mean, do you view NATO as stronger or weaker than 5 years ago?
NATO is definitely stronger than it was 5 years ago. It's stronger than it was 8 years ago when Trump said in Cleveland in the GOP convention in 2016 that if all the free riders didn't step up and start paying their fair share, we'd have to evaluate our commitment to NATO. And guess what? It was five NATO countries paying 2% of GDP statutorily. Then it was eight. Now it's 10. And a lot of the bigger countries who are already paying are adding to their defense budgets. It's definitely stronger. Matt Whitaker's doing a good job relationally on the ground. But the good thing is also NATO now knows its place more. It is definitely directed by American strategy, which is good because we are paying for most of it, and our strategic interests are a lot more aligned with those who just want a stable world, not just you know, a hard left political ideological world. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when NATO was trotting out LGBT flags. What does that have to do with NATO's mandate? Absolutely nothing. So I think NATO's stronger, but it also understands its place more as deferential to Washington, and that's also a good thing.
Wow. Well, you know, so much to pay attention to and so much going on with this. But Matt Tierman, really appreciate your time and your commentary today. You can follow him at Matthew Tierman. And, you know, when is this supposed to take place, this meeting between Putin and Trump? Because they're just saying, you know, in the forthcoming days in Alaska. Do we actually have a date set?
I believe what I heard was the end of this week, Friday, Saturday. But before that, right now, there is a call going on between NATO, German and French and European leaders, and Trump and Zelensky to set some strategic ground approaches to this. So Trump is diplomatically taking input from those other stakeholders, which is good.
Which is good. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the art of the deal, right? All right. Well, Matt, thanks so much.
Deal.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's all the time that we have for today on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. As always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.